Pakistan declares a state of emergency as more than 30 million people are affected by devastating flooding across much of the country. Russia accuses Ukraine of shelling the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. Moscow and Kiev have been trading blame for shelling near the plant since its capture by Russia. Plus, a strike by Scottish refuse workers over pay is spreading to more cities as the cost of living crisis triggers a wave of industrial action across the UK. This is news. Thanks for joining us. Pakistan has been grappling with monsoon flooding that has swept much of the country. Officials say the death toll has almost reached the 1,000 mark since mid-June. The government has declared an emergency and has mobilized the military. Thousands of residents in critical areas have been ordered to evacuate their homes. Pakistan has called for international assistance to cope with the aftermath of the natural disaster. Authorities say this year's monsoon flooding has affected over 33 million people and nearly 1 million homes have been destroyed or badly damaged. This year's floods are comparable to those of 2010, the worst on record. That year, over 2,000 people died and nearly a fifth of the country was underwater. Nasser Kazmi joined us a short while ago from the flood-hit city of Nowshera with the latest updates.
The water level is coming up as the time is passing. More rain is expecting in the next 24 hours. So Pakistanis are in real trouble at the moment, especially people living in Balochistan province, Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, and the Sindh province. There are a lot of people who are still stranded in the flood's water. And the concern is that how long this rain will continue in the country. Rescue operations are taking place, but still a lot of things have to be done in this regard. The government is trying very hard to cope the situation. The parliamentarians have announced that they will donate their 1 month's salary for the flood donation. Same time, the government has announced a huge amount for the flood relief activities, but international aid is very necessary for the people who are in trouble at the moment.
Kiev and Moscow have once again accused each other of shelling Europe's largest nuclear power plant in southern Ukraine. Ukraine's state nuclear company warned of a risk of radioactive leak at the Zaporizhzhia facility. The company said Russia has repeatedly attacked its infrastructure over the past 24 hours. Moscow authorities said Ukrainian forces have attacked the complex three times in the same period. On Thursday, the plant was disconnected from the Ukrainian grid for the first time in its history, but the connection was later restored. Disconnecting from the grid may lead to a catastrophic failure of the cooling systems at the site. Russia captured Zaporizhzhia in March, but the facility is run by Ukrainian technicians. Protesters have gathered outside the office of the British energy regulator Ofgem in London. That came after Ofgem confirmed the cost of electricity and gas will rise by 80% as of October the 1st.
Energy price cap rise, which has risen to over £3,500, is intolerable for working people, for people in poverty, for people out of work in Britain right now. I'm here because our parliamentary political parties have failed us, continue to fail us. Whether Labour or Conservative, they offer no solution to the people already in poverty and in worse situations, and to the people who will be put into poverty come October when this price cap rise comes into effect.
The protest was organized by Don't Pay UK. That is a campaign calling on people to stop paying their bills at the renewed prices. Ofgem has partly blamed the increase on the Russia-Ukraine war that has led to a curb in Russian energy supplies to Europe. Leaders of parliaments in Wales and in Scotland, as well as British opposition parties, have called for an immediate freeze on the price increase. Britons are also grappling with soaring food prices. That, coupled with the rising energy prices, sent inflation to above 10% in July, a rate unseen in over 40 years. Scotland is hit by industrial action. Refuse workers have been on a strike for 9 days now, or a pay dispute with local authorities. The strike began in the capital, Edinburgh, now spreading to more than a dozen cities. The action is set to continue until Tuesday, despite talks ongoing between authorities and union leaders. The workers want higher salaries in line with the rising inflation. The action has already left this impact, with garbage from unattended bins overflowing to the streets. It has caused criticism against the government as well. Opposition politicians are accusing it of apathy in the dispute and shifting blame onto local city councils. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. The U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman has warned Americans of painful action as the country struggles to curb soaring inflation.
Reducing inflation is likely to require a sustained period of below-trend growth. Moreover, there will very likely be some softening of labor market conditions. While higher interest rates, slower growth, and softer labor market conditions will bring down inflation, they will also bring some pain to households and businesses.
As Powell outlined the government's plans to tame inflation, he noted that it would take some time to restore price stability. But he stressed that the current economic situation in the U.S. requires using the, quote, tools forcefully. Powell also warned of far greater pain if outlined measures are not adopted. Inflation has hit a four-decade high in the U.S. as prices for gas, food, and rent continue to climb at the fastest pace. Mike Harris, finance editor at Veterans Today, joins us from Phoenix. We also have Eric Wahlberg, author and journalist, joining us from Toronto. Welcome to you both. Mike Harris, let's see how bad the situation really is in the States and whether what Powell is subscribing to, which is obviously taming inflation through the interest rates, is that actually going to work?
Well, I don't know. What they've done is they've printed and created so much money, and Biden administration has been physical, so irresponsible with these new programs that they've been passing. I really don't see a way out of this. We had a news article this week that came out that said 20 million American households are behind on their electrical bills, can't afford power. How is this going to impact the population? And so these things, they really made a mess out of this. All in all, they've just been printing way too much money. The government's been spending way too much money. We're really in a bind here, and I don't see any easy way out of it. And I don't know that if raising the interest rates is going to help, because by raising the interest rates, you're going to have marginal businesses, which are barely servicing their debt now, are not going to be able to service the debt. The cost of federal borrowing is going to go up. And so you're going to have more of the federal budget is going to be going to interest payments versus doing anything productive for the people. They've really got themselves into the death part of the downward spiral here. They're really stuck, and they don't have very many good choices, if any good choices, ahead of them.
Well, Eric Wahlberg, while we're seeing the squeeze on Americans through a variety of things that are happening in that country, like inflation, for example, or high energy prices, I'm wondering how Americans feel when they hear almost on a weekly basis, if not maybe just a few days apart at some points, that Ukraine is getting billions and billions of dollars from the U.S. I think the latest at this point was $3 billion, putting it at over $10 billion.
It's terrible, and Americans are turning against this. The positive opinion for pursuing this war against Russia are steadily decreasing. It's now less than half of Americans actually approve of this war. I believe it was slightly over 50. I think it's just under now and continuing to fall. So that, and Mike is right, just putting the jacking up interest rate, that's just going to create, its main effect will be to create recession and also to put unemployment increase so that you have wages to try and control wages. But you see, this militancy in the U.S. Since COVID and even this Floyd, there's just a lot of unrest in the U.S. And it's on a mass level. So the it's going to really backfire to just rely. It's a cowardly way of trying to fight inflation, jacking up interest rates. You don't. You just sign something, and then you sit back and you wait for the mess. But there is a perfect. Mike says he has no idea how to deal with this. Well, I certainly do, and I think most people in the world realize that the way to deal with this is to jack up not interest rates, but taxes on the rich. That's how you deal with inflation. But that takes guts. And show me an American government or Canadian or any Western government now with any guts, and I will shake your hand.
One of the focuses of what is happening in the States, or one of the reasons, Mike Harris, if you agree, is the rising energy prices that has led to a variety of consequences such as inflation. But it's not just about the energy price being what it is, but and the U.S. economy to be in a state because of the Ukraine conflict, but rather before the Ukraine conflict started, do you agree that the state of the U.S. economy was not exactly in tip-top shape? And that doesn't just get is applicable to the U.S. Many countries actually around the world were not doing that well economically speaking, even not during COVID, even before COVID happened.
Well, I agree. This has been a long, lingering problem. The U.S. Voluntarily gutted their manufacturing base and gutted their economy by passing NAFTA, GATT, and letting China into the WTO when they exported over 35, 40 million jobs into China. So even if the Fed would stimulate the economy through low interest rate, it does no good to the U.S. manufacturing base and the U.S. working class, because those jobs no longer reside in the United States. They're resident in China. It'll pump up the Chinese economy, but it doesn't help the U.S. economy. So the Fed has really sort of hogtied themselves, along with fiscal policy has embraced. And these are all feckless policies that have been going back to Ronald Reagan. He's the one who first started deficit spending. And that was supposed to be temporary to jumpstart the economy. It worked good for a while, but they never went back to a balanced budget. We have fiat currency that has no intrinsic value. And right now, the global economy, or the global countries, transaction, commerce, business, are really second guessing if the dollar is really the right place to put their investment. And the dollar seems to be doing better than other currencies now, but it is merely the cleanest shirt and the dirty hamper. So it looks better than other economies, but not much. So they've got some problems, and they really have to start looking at things like broad-scale debt forgiveness, perhaps, against working class to benefit working class people. But how do you do that and not injure the investor class? So they've really got a sticky wicket here. There is no easy solution like just raising taxes on the rich. I mean, you could raise taxes on everybody who makes more than $500,000 a year and still not put a dent in the deficit spending that this government has. It takes a multi-pronged approach of reducing government spending, stopping this stupid spending they've been doing on these idiotic wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, now in Ukraine, stop all this nonsense, trim back the social spending in the U.S. as far as your welfare and other things, and try to put this country back to work, get us on an ability to restore our manufacturing base here and bring jobs back to the U.S. We don't need the illegal aliens that are coming in the country, undermining the wages of the working class people, is damaging entry-level jobs the most, the hardest. So our least capable, most vulnerable people are paying the hardest price for this. So the U.S. really is in a bind, and I look for some real, real pain as the Federal Reserve tries to tinker their way out of this. I think it's time to do away with the Federal Reserve and restore these functions back to the U.S. Treasury.
Thank you, Eric Wahlberg, author and journalist. Mike Harris, thank you. Finance editor at Veterans Today from Phoenix. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in. Welcome back. Gunfire and explosions have rocked the Libyan capital, Tripoli, as clashes erupt between rival armed groups, raising fears of an all-out conflict in a country grappling with a political crisis. The violence has left at least one person dead. Health officials say an unknown number of civilians have also been wounded. though reports of indiscriminate shelling in civilian populated neighborhoods. A mosque and a health clinic were reportedly set on fire. The UN's Libya mission has called for an immediate cessation of hostilities. The two rival administrations based in Tripoli and Tobruk are exchanging blame for the violence. The government of national unity, led by Abdelhamid Dibaba, says that the fighting broke out after negotiations to avoid bloodshed and the city collapsed. Beba's government was installed in Tripoli last year as part of a UN-led peace process to lead a transition to elections. His administration is challenged by the Tobruk-based administration of former interior minister Fathi Bashagha. Bashagha is backed by Libya's parliament and eastern-based military strongman Khalifa Haftar. Tunisia says that it will recall its ambassador to Rabat for consultations following a similar move by Morocco. Relations between the North African neighbors have soured in recent days. That after the Tunisian president hosted the head of the Polisario Front, Brahim Ghali, who arrived in Tunis on Friday to attend a high-profile conference. The move angered Morocco, since the movement seeks independence in the Western Sahara, which Morocco sees as a sovereign part of its own territory. Rabat called the move, quote, hostile and unnecessarily provocative. It also withdrew its Tunis ambassador for consultations and canceled its participation in the Japanese African Investment Conference. The Tunisian Foreign Ministry has expressed surprise at Morocco's reaction. It says that Tunis has maintained total neutrality on the Western Sahara issue with respect to international law. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight. In the U.S., the Standard & Poor's 500 fell 3.4%, its lowest daily showing since mid-June, after the U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman spoke about the path ahead for monetary policy. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Joe Renison. The piece is titled Stocks Plunge After Fed Chair Warns of Pain from Inflation Fight. Wall Street recoiled on Friday, 26th of August, after the head of the Federal Reserve delivered a stern warning that the central bank's campaign to lower inflation by raising interest rates is unconditional, even if it leads to pain for households, businesses, and in turn for stock prices. The Standard & Poor's 500 fell 3.4%, its worst daily showing since mid-June, taking its losses for the week to 4%. The slump was broad, with every sector of the index lower. Bond investors also quickly adjusted for more rate increases from the Fed, with a 2-year Treasury yield, which is sensitive to rising interest rates, moving close to its highest level of the year at 3.44%, before easing back to 3.38%. While higher interest rates, lower growth, and softer labour market conditions will bring down inflation, they will also bring some pain to American households and businesses, Jerome Powell, the Federal Reserve Chairman, said during a speech at the Kansas City's Fed's annual conference in Wyoming. These are the unfortunate costs of reducing inflation, but a failure to restore price stability would mean far greater pain. The central bank is grappling with the task of guiding the American economy out of a global pandemic at a time when pent-up demand, broken supply chains, and soaring energy costs have helped propel the fastest pace of price increases in a generation. The central bank is expected to raise interest rates to their highest level since 2008. When officials meet in September, increasing borrowing costs for consumers and companies and cooling the U.S. economy. Investors had expected Jerome Powell to caution that the central bank's task of fighting inflation was far from complete, after a host of other U.S. Federal Reserve officials had communicated a similar message in recent weeks. In anticipation, they pulled nearly $1 billion from funds that invest in U.S. stocks for the week through Wednesday, according to data from EPFR Global. Funds that buy low-rate bonds, known as junk bonds, saw more than $4 billion of withdrawals. Still, the clarity of Jerome Powell's comments on Friday, 26th of August, removed any uncertainty about his intentions to make economic conditions more restrictive, said Lee Ferridge, head of macro strategy for North America at State Street Global Markets. This was not the Powell we normally see, where he tries to be more balanced, Mr. Ferridge said. I don't see how you could take what he said any other way. Such caution reflects a marked change of sentiment on Wall Street, where trading in July and early August had been defined by a roaring market rebound, in part predicted under the idea that the U.S. Federal Reserve was about to start easing off its aggressive campaign of raising interest rates. After plunging over 23% for the year through to mid-June, the Standard & Poor's 500 rallied more than 17% over the next 2 months. Jerome Powell's remarks offered the strongest case yet that investors had gotten ahead of themselves. Following Friday's market moves, the index remains about 15% lower for this year. Our responsibility to deliver price stability is unconditional, Jerome Powell said. Some continue to question Mr. Powell's conviction. The central bank has stepped in to support financial markets on numerous occasions since the 2008 financial crisis. Andrew Brenner, head of the International Fixed Income at National Alliance Securities, suggested that the Federal Reserve might come to investors' rescue again if its decision to maintain an extended period of higher interest rates damages the economy. I continue to not believe him, Andrew Brenner said. Trading in some corners of the financial markets offered signs that Mr. Brenner is not alone in thinking that the Federal Reserve may end up easing its campaign. Investors continue to bet on the Federal Reserve cutting interest rates next year, contrary to the central bank's own predictions. Futures prices that forecast the path of Federal Reserve interest rate increases rise through June 2023, before falling through the second half of next year. The Federal Reserve's policymakers' median prediction has rates remaining elevated until 2024. Investors took some relief from a fresh inflation report on Friday, which showed that the pace of price increases in the United States continues to moderate, with some investors viewing the numbers as limiting the need for further U.S. Federal Reserve action. A second data set showed a decline in future expectations for the rate of inflation. Attention will now turn to the U.S. government's monthly update on the labor market that is due next week, with a focus on any sign that hiring and unemployment are worsening. So far, despite some expectations that higher borrowing costs would eventually slow hiring, employers in the United States have continued to add jobs, and the unemployment rate has matched its 50-year low. I believe once Jerome Powell starts to see unemployment pick up, he will shy away, Andrew Brenner said. The backdrop sets up a month that already sits uncomfortably in investors' psyche. Seasonally, September is the worst month for the Standard & Poor's 500, according to the index analyst Howard Silverblatt. It's a challenging few weeks ahead, said Mr. Ferriage of State Street Global Markets. The U.S. Federal Reserve has talked about causing pain and how markets have to react. It's hard to make a positive case for equities after this.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
So, dear brothers and sisters, welcome back to the lecture series, which has been titled The Quiet Before the Storm. And the idea is to look at the words, the thoughts, and the stances of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and those who are with him, to derive relevant lessons for our living Imam. Today, inshallah, the lesson will be from the camp of Imam Hussein. The person who will be remembering tonight is Hazrat Abbas. The lessons, if I were going to give them a title, the first one would be learning or the art of being a good soldier. So, brothers and sisters, what we've been learning from the beginning of these lessons, these reminders that we've been getting from Aba Abdullah, is that Islam is a perfect religion, and it gives us the best of this world and the next. But the thing about Islam is that in order for us to experience joy and salvation and Allah's best, it has to be implemented. So what we learned is that Islam had to be implemented. We can't pick and choose with Islam. Islam is not a buffet. If we implement Islam, then we experience Allah's best. There's a very beautiful hadith from Imam Sadiq, salamullahi alayhi. Salawat, please. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. One of the companions, so the believers say, we were sitting in the gathering with Imam Sadiq. What a blessed gathering that was. And then one of us made a dua in the presence of the Imam. He said, "Oh Allah, I ask you for paradise. As'alukal jannah. Please grant me paradise." He said this in the presence of the Imam, and the response of the Imam for us was a little bit strange. The Imam said something a little different. He said, "Antum fil jannah." You're in Jannah. Right now you're in Jannah. He said, your dua should be that Allah not take you out of Jannah. And we were shocked. We were surprised. What does that mean? Right now, we're in Jannah? The Imam said, don't you believe in our imamah? You believe that we are the imams? You're implementing Islam? You're practicing Islam? We believe, as Shia, that whatever we do, in the next world, it takes on a corporal form. We're literally, right now, the money that brothers and sisters are donating for the cause, for the school, for anything here, that's literally us building paradise right now. Right now, we're going, when Allah removes the veils, we'll experience the thawab of these majalis. We'll see what these tears really mean. But that's over there. So the Imam said, you're in Jannah right now. Ask Allah that He not remove you from Jannah. And that's what we're trying to do, brothers and sisters, because we've heard those ayat of the Quran where Allah says, وَعَتِيُوا اللَّهَ وَرَسُولَهُ, and obey Allah and the Messenger, إِن كُنْتُم مُؤْمِنِينَ, if you are believers. The condition for faith, for iman, is action. So what we're trying to do is to not be our own worst enemies, to take ourselves out of paradise. What we're trying to do in these gatherings, with these reminders that we're getting from the camp of Aba Abdullah, is not to come out of paradise, to implement, to act, and to see those beauties that Allah has for us. So back to our first topic, which was the fine art of being a good soldier. Brothers and sisters, if you and I are to give a lecture about the leadership style of Sayyidul Shuhada, there are so many lessons that could be drawn, the leadership style of Imam Hussein. But to me, what I'd like to talk about is something else. Because you see, in Islam, that's a very good discussion. Inshallah, either scholars have discussed it or they will discuss it. So many parallels. What I want to talk about is something else. From an Islamic point of view, we're actually not supposed to be looking for leadership, thirsty for leadership. For us, there's no ego in the idea of being a leader, being in charge, telling people what to do. In the other world, in the dunya, people look for those positions. They justify, they feel good about themselves because they're lording over others. In Islam, it's an opportunity to serve. Each one of us will read the hadith. We do have a leadership role. But the leadership role, the circle of influence that we have, it's an opportunity to serve. The hadith says this, Sayyidul Qawm Khadimuhum. The leader of a group of people, the person who's respected, who's in the limelight, who's giving direction, that person, Khadimuhum, is a servant of those people. This is an opportunity for me to serve the cause. So actually, from an Islamic point of view, when it comes to positions, looking for them, that's something actually that we're told not to do. We take it as a responsibility, but it's a heavy responsibility. Why? The hadith says this, on the day of judgment, whoever is responsible for leading 10 or more people, this is from Rasulullah, whoever is responsible for leading 10 or more people, I'm a manager, I'm a leader, I'm in charge, people are looking to me, I'm directing them. Whoever is responsible for leading 10 or more people will first be brought to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in chains. The hisab starts in chains. Someone like myself, I'm responsible. First, the hisab starts in chains. After that, God will check to see whether you and I, those of us who are in a position of leadership, we had a circle of influence, were we good or not? If we made mistakes, if we didn't do our responsibility properly, the chains will increase. Otherwise, then of course, the chains will be removed. That's why we literally look at, instead of that thirst that's, I want to be in charge, not from an Islamic point of view. What happens, though, is that we do need to learn how to function when I'm not the person who makes the last call. When it's not my final decision. Brothers and sisters, you're blessed here to be in a very good organization. Inshallah, brothers and sisters will continue to live here in the Bay Area. But if you move to other areas, you'll see that how many times is it that an Islamic organization has been brought down by ego of mu'mineen. If we haven't learned to corral the ego, if we haven't learned to be a good soldier, when I'm not, it's not my final decision. How many good organizations? Sometimes it's families. This concept of being a good soldier, we haven't learned it properly. How many families fall apart because of the same issue? When I'm living in my house with my father, right? I'm still living in the house, right? Again, the idea of being a good soldier. If I'm working in an Islamic organization, somebody else is the lead. I've got a bright idea. I'm sharing my ideas. They're not being taken. Let's say I don't feel heard. Does that mean I separate myself, I distance myself from the organization? Let's say it's a marriage. Sometimes these issues of leadership and how we make decisions in marriages, marriages fall apart.
We say you live forever in our hearts and in our minds.
Oh, we say you live forever
in our hearts and in our minds. I swear to Allah and to my last breath, I will remember
to Allah whenever I face troubles in my life. I close my eyes and see your shrine and call the back every time. Oh, Hussein, you're the love of my heart. You are the light of my eyes. I swear to Allah, until my last breath, I will remember Hussein.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The world's top four grain traders, which have dominated the global grain market for decades, have seen record or near-record profits or sales. they are forecasting demand to outstrip supply at least until 2024, which is likely to lead to even higher sales and higher profits in the next 2 years. We now present you an article written by Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled, Record Profits for Grain Firms Amid Food Crisis Prompt Calls for Windfall Tax. Companies at the center of the global grain trade have enjoyed a record bonanza amid soaring food prices around the world, raising concerns of profiteering and speculation in global food markets that could put staples beyond the reach of the poorest and prompting calls for a windfall tax. The world's top four grain traders, which have dominated the global grain market for decades, have seen record or near-record profits or sales. They are forecasting demand to outstrip supply at least until 2024, which is likely to lead to even higher sales and higher profits over the next 2 years. According to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, food prices have surged more than 20% this year. According to the World Food Programme, WFP, about 345 million people are experiencing acute food insecurity, compared with 135 million people before the COVID-19 pandemic. Olivier De Schutter, a co-chair of the IPES Food, the International Panel of Experts on Sustainable Food Systems, IPES Food, and United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, said, "The fact that global commodity giants are making record profits at a time when hunger is rising is clearly unjust and is a terrible indictment of our food systems. What's even worse, these companies could have done more to prevent the hunger crisis in the first place." Four companies, the Archer Daniels Midlands Company, Bunge, Cargill and Louis Dreyfus, known collectively as ABCD, control an estimated 70 to 90% of the global grain trade. Olivier De Schutter, the co-chair of the International Panel of Experts on Sustainable Food Systems, said, "Global grain markets are even more concentrated than energy markets and even less transparent, so there is a huge risk of profiteering." Olivier De Schutter said this year's food price surge happened despite what are thought to be abundant global grain reserves, but there was insufficient transparency from the companies to show how much grain they hold and no way to force them to release stocks in a timely fashion. Olivier De Schutter added, "We need to be looking at the grain giants and asking what they could have done to avert the crisis and what they could be doing right now." Cargill reported a 23% increase in revenues to a record $165 billion for the year ending 31st of May, while Archer Daniels Midland made the highest profit in its history during the second quarter of this year. Sales at Bunge surged by 17% year-on-year in the second quarter, though its profits were affected by previously incurred charges. Louis Dreyfus reported profits for 2021 up by more than 80% on the previous year, as revenues rose by nearly a quarter to $1.62 billion. John Rogers, an analyst at the credit rating service Moody's, said, "It was not surprising that supply constraints and rebounding demand had increased food prices and led to higher profits." John Rogers claimed, "I don't think they're colluding for outsized profits," adding that many more companies were also taking an increasing share of global grain markets. John Rogers claimed, "I don't think they're acting immorally. they're not intentionally driving up prices. He said the profits for grain companies had been increasing overall, but their margins had not markedly increased in percentage terms, adding, "This is a relatively efficient market. I don't think these guys can ramp up the prices." However, unpublished analysis by a non-governmental organization seen by The Guardian suggests that some food companies may be increasing their profit margins too. The analysis found Archer's Daniel Midland increased its profit margin to 4.46% in the first quarter of this year, up from 3.65% in the same quarter in 2021. And Cargill's profit margin increased from 2.5% last year to 3.2% this year. Sandra Martinson, a policy manager at Bond, a network of international development charities, said a windfall tax would be a way to restore some balance to food markets and help the poorest. Sandra Martinson said, "The big agri-food companies are clearly capitalizing on the reduced supply and increased demand, further exacerbated by commodity trading." She added, "When supply is significantly lower than demand, it gives space for price increases. But this is also exacerbated by speculative stock markets, since wheat and other commodities are traded in stock markets and therefore prices fluctuate." Oxfam has also called for a windfall tax on food companies' profits. Alex Maitland, a senior advisor at Oxfam, said, "There are fears that speculation could be a driver in food price rises. Anything that causes hunger and starvation is immoral." Natalie Bennett, a UK Green Party peer, joined the call. She said, "As a short-term measure, there are strong arguments for a windfall tax on the food oligopolies. The handful of companies with significant cross-ownership from hedge funds and from seeds to supermarkets are major contributors to the inflation that's driving the cost of living crisis to new heights." Vicky Hurd, the head of sustainable farming at the UK food coalition Sustain, stopped short of calling for a windfall tax, as she said it was hard to separate out the price effects in supermarkets where consumers buy most of their food. But she called for the British government to regulate to stop abuse. She said, "While farmers, consumers and food workers are suffering in the face of spiralling food prices and fuel prices, those sitting in the middle of the food chain, a small number of huge dominant grain traders, are raking in vast profits." Sandra Martinson said if government rejects a windfall tax, they should consider other means to curb prices, including price caps or tighter regulation on commodity trading, such as the ban on commodity trading introduced in India to limit inflation and price hikes. Sandra Martinson said food companies and commodity speculators were also blamed for fueling the food price rises seen more than a decade ago, when surging prices led to riots in many countries. The causes of the food price rises are complex. The war in Ukraine has played a big part, as Ukraine is one of the world's top producers of grain, sunflower oil, maize, and fertilizer. The war sent food prices soaring to their highest ever levels in March, though some have fallen back slightly since then. A standoff with Russia over moving grain shipments from Ukraine for export has been partially resolved, and some shipments have now moved. But harvests from Ukraine and Russia will be affected this year as well as next year. Rising energy and fertilizer prices, which have also spiraled due to Russia's special operation in Ukraine, have an impact, while the rebound in demand after COVID lockdowns has added further pressure. Grain harvests in Europe, in North America and India have also been affected by the climate crisis. Last year's heat waves in Canada hurt wheat crop yields in Canada, and high temperatures and wildfires this year are likely to inflict damage. This all adds up to a rosy picture for grain producers. Demand for their product is surging, supplies are constrained, and despite rising input prices in the form of energy and fertilizer, their profits look secure. The Guardian contacted all four of the ABCD companies for comment, but has not received any replies. Olivier de Schutter said, "Ultimately, we need to break up the monopolies that have a stranglehold on the food chain. A handful of companies control global seed and fertilizer markets, animal genetics, the global grain trade, and food retail. They're making huge profits at the cost of farmers, at the cost of consumers and the environment. In Britain, food prices have risen for many staples, adding to woes over energy prices that are set to top £3,500 a year this winter for the average British household. Poverty campaigners have warned people are facing harsh choices this winter over whether to eat or to heat their homes."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Friday prayer leaders from across the country in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on July 27, 2022.
The IRIB and our officials need to inform people that the Friday prayer is not merely a congregational prayer in a mosque. Rather, it is a great and important phenomenon in a city. Some of its features, which I will now state. I will first state these, then I will talk a bit about the gap that exists between the Friday prayers that exist today and how the Friday prayers should really be. Does a gap even exist or not? Naturally, there is one. What matters is how we can close this gap. Well, thankfully, there are close to 1,000 or 900 in some Friday prayer leaders across the country. And this is a truly significant number in both big and small cities. They should really do something. If our Friday prayers, the way they are today, are the way that the Friday prayers have been defined to be and held in the way that is expected of them, then the situation should be a bit better than this. That is, there should be some differences. Therefore, this is one of the issues which I will discuss during my talk so that we can try to close this gap.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Now, who should be the one making this effort? A part of this effort that needs to be undertaken is the responsibility of the Friday prayer leader himself. The Friday prayer leader should make this effort. Another part of it is the responsibility of the respected officials who are present in the center for policy making and collective management of the Friday prayer leaders in Tehran and in other centers. As for the position that the Friday prayers hold, let me tell you in one word that the Friday prayer is a totally unique religious duty and there's nothing like it. When we look into the depths of the phenomenon of the Friday prayer, we see that it is even more unique than Hajj, which is a great multifaceted event. I will discuss some examples of these features now. If you think about this, you will find even more features, especially now that you're faced with this obligation yourselves. One feature is that the Friday prayer connects and ties together two essential factors that are part of a pure life. What are these two factors? One is the remembrance of God, dhikr. The other is the presence of the people.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.